How did the recruitment of the Navy develop through the period of 1790 to 1918?
Naval manpower recruitment between the outbreak of the French Revolutionary War and the outbreak of the First World War is a really important study in how states organise themselves and how organisations within the state, particularly in this case the Navy, responds to changing technology and changing political circumstances. In 1793, the Royal Navy manned ships in peacetime by voluntary recruitment. Men were encouraged to sign on by being offered a bounty or pay or simply the availability of work. And a navy which in 1792 had around 15,000 men at sea had little trouble recruiting enough men. The next year it needed 100,000 men and it had huge problems because there weren't 100,000 skilled seafarers out there to recruit. So the navy had to offer larger bounties, it had to recruit large numbers of unskilled landsmen who might be trained up as sailors but were not skilled men. And it resorted to the age-old right of the English Crown to impress mariners. Skilled seafarers had been subject to impressment for centuries. They were not subject to being impressed into the militia, they were not to be taken into the army because sailors are far more important than soldiers, they're skilled men. They have transferable seafaring skills. Soldiers can be trained in 6 months, sailors take 6 years. It's a much more demanding job. So impressment only applied to skilled seafarers. And throughout the wars against the French Revolution and Napoleon, the Navy was constantly impressing seafarers because in order to maintain a Navy which got up to 140,000 men at sea, that was the only system that was going to generate results. Other navies on the continent had conscription systems. The French and the Danes resorted to a system that we would see as modern conscription. All the seafaring population were registered and they were summoned to serve at the will of the state. The British used a slightly more hand-to-mouth system because the British have never been so good at doing things by numbers. The British system worked. It enabled the great fleets to go to sea. It enabled the Royal Navy to win all of the battles. And while impressment was not a particularly liberal system, it was effective, and the liberty of the few was sacrificed to the survival of the many, which is how we fight wars in the 20th century. Conscripting men to fight avoids losing the war, and this is certainly the case in Nelson's day. Most of the men who were impressed into the Navy accepted it as an occupational hazard of being a seafarer in the Atlantic seafaring world. If you spoke English and had maritime skills, you were likely to be impressed at some stage in your career. When the war ended, you would be paid off and you could return to other occupations. So it was controversial in the main because some of the people who were impressed were not British, particularly in the case of the Americans. It's often said that the Anglo-American War of 1812 was caused by impressment. This is wrong. The people who started the War of 1812 lived in the inland provinces of America, and their main aim was the conquest of Canada. The people who ran North Atlantic trade in American harbors opposed the war and did not object overly to impressment. It was an occupational hazard. It was people in Kentucky and Tennessee who thought that impressment was something they could use as an excuse to invade Canada. The matter was not raised by the Americans at the peace treaty at the end of the war because the British had won the war. And the Americans who were signing the peace weren't interested in impressment anyway, because they were the same people who'd started the war. After the war, the Royal Navy retained the right to impress, but never again impressed, because no circumstance emerged in the next 50 years in which it was necessary. Had Britain gone to war with a major naval power in the 1820s, 30s or 40s, impressment would almost certainly have been resorted to. A war with France and Russia combined would have seen large numbers of men impressed into the Royal Navy. But it didn't happen. And from the 1830s, the Royal Navy began to change its recruitment. Instead of simply waiting for men to join the Navy on a ship-by-ship basis, Nelson sailors didn't belong to the Navy, they belonged to a ship. If you signed on to HMS Victory, that was your connection with the Navy. And if HMS Victory paid off, you paid off with it. You were not a naval rating, you were a Victory rating. In wartime, men were transferred from ship to ship. But in peacetime, you served for as long as the ship was in commission. From the 1830s onwards, highly trained gunnery ratings in the Royal Navy joined the Navy for a period of 10 or 20 years. They were now part of the Navy, not just the ship. And over time, the Navy recognized the need to build up a reserve for wartime, so the small peacetime Navy could be increased at the outbreak of war. And these men would be time-served naval ratings who had served 10 or 20 years and would be paid a retainer so they would come back to serve in the event of war. In 1852, the Navy introduced a new system of recruitment, continuous service. So all naval ratings now entered for a period of 10 years and could extend to 20 years and claim both a pension and a bounty for reserve service. This transformed the Navy from pre-modern come-as-you-like organisation into one that had a clearly defined body of sailors who were now all part of the same organisation. And men would move from ship to ship rather than being continuously stuck in the same ship's company. And over time, this system produced a very large and effective naval reserve of professional naval ratings. This was critical because the shared skills between merchant seafarers and naval ratings began to diminish as new technologies reached the Navy. In Nelson's day, men who could work aloft in the rigging, could steer the ship, mend the equipment, they had no trouble picking up handling heavy guns because they were relatively straightforward pieces of technology. By the 1860s, the Navy is using technologies that nobody in the Merchant Navy has ever seen. Complicated weapon systems, torpedoes, modern rifle breech-loading artillery, very advanced forms of propulsion. And so the Navy needed its own special version of a sailor. He wasn't just a sailor, he was a naval rating, and his naval skills were the key to his usefulness in the Navy and as a reserve. By the 1890s, the Navy had recognised that in the event of a major war, there wouldn't be enough naval reservists. So it started to introduce other forms of reserve, the Royal Naval Reserve, which took in many men in merchant seafaring, particularly in the great steam liner companies that carried British government mail around the world, Cunard, P&O, Royal Mail. Many of these ships were earmarked for war service as auxiliary cruisers, as troop transports, and what the Navy wanted was to take over the ship and pretty much all of the ship's company all at once. So these men would overnight become Royal Navy personnel. So they too were Royal Naval Reservists, highly skilled men operating a ship that they were very familiar with. All the Navy would do was send a captain on board and some guns and some gun crew. Everything else would carry on as normal. These ships were essential to patrolling the world ocean. There simply weren't enough Royal Navy warships to do everything. And then in the First World War, you find all of these coming together and also a Royal Naval Voluntary Reserve, men who don't have a maritime background but are still volunteering. And this means the Navy in the First World War does not conscript. And in the Second World War, it effectively doesn't conscript. It takes volunteers. So the Royal Navy is able to avoid the problems of mass conscription in the two world wars. The Navy isn't taking that many men because the 1939 Royal Naval Reserve is so large, it's able to man the war fleet from that, and recruitment during the war is relatively straightforward. So what the Navy has avoided is having to deal with large numbers of unskilled, inexperienced men who are completely useless on board a ship. So it means that it has a large body of skilled men into which it can introduce a smaller number of less skilled men and continue their training. In the Second World War, it's the Royal Naval Reserve that provides much of the manpower for the Battle of the Atlantic, this huge campaign against submarines, leaving the regular Royal Navy to fight the surface and air war against Germany, Italy, and Japan. These methods, I think, demonstrate just how adept the British state was at moving the goalposts of its policy to ensure that when the great wars broke out, it had the right people in the right place at the right time. Because Britain, for all its impact on the world in the last 200 years, is still a very small country with a pretty small population. So it's about making very good use of the resources you have. The contrast with countries like the Soviet Union, the United States in the Second World War, these are countries with enormous human resources, and they can afford to be relatively inefficient. Whereas Britain is actually the most efficiently mobilised country of all in the Second World War, and the Royal Navy is at the forefront of that mobilisation. Britain gets more out of its war effort per head than anybody else. It gets more war production, it gets more military manpower per head of population than anybody else. And that isn't accidental, that's very deliberate, and it goes back to the Napoleonic Wars. The same ideas that drove Britain through this first total war of national mobilization, making choices between where to apply manpower, between domestic industry, trade, frontline manpower, army versus navy, and the Second World War Air Force as well, making those balanced choices so you're achieving the most effective use of all of the resources, industrial, human, financial, in order to promote the war effort. And this joined up thinking about war is something that no other country achieved, even in the Second World War. Britain is a better organized and more efficient warfighting state in 1914 than any of its significant rivals, and remains so pretty much to the end of the Second World War. It's not as big as some of them by the end of the Second World War, but it's certainly significantly more efficient.